House Committee on Energy and Environment will come to order. Thank you all for joining us today. Hopefully we will have an interesting discussion. And start by opening an informational meeting on climate responsible investments. I'd like to call up a panel of four. Sandy Polishuk, Emily Lethenstrom, Christy Split, and Walter Eager. I hope I got those last names right. I apologize if I did not. We appreciate you making time to come down and present to the committee, and we're interested to hear what you have to say.
Chair Bailey and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sandy Polishuk. I live at 1610 Northeast Tillamook in Portland. I'm with 350 PDX, the Portland chapter of 350.org. We appreciate and thank you for allowing us to come talk to you today about fossil fuel divestment. 350 PPM is where our organization gets its name. PPM stands for parts per million, which is simply a way of measuring the ratio of carbon dioxide molecules to all the other molecules in the atmosphere. Many scientists, climate experts, and progressive national governments agree that 350 ppm is the safe level of carbon dioxide. Since the beginning of human civilization, our atmosphere contained 275 ppm of carbon dioxide. Beginning in the 18th century, humans began to burn coal, gas, and oil, and the amount of carbon in the atmosphere began to rise, at first slowly, and now more quickly. Right now, we're at nearly 400 ppm. Every year, we're adding 2 ppm of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. Millions of people have witnessed climate disruption firsthand in the terrible droughts, floods, heat waves, wildfires, and storms that have ravaged much of the globe. Unless we're able to rapidly turn that around and return to below 350 ppm this century, we risk triggering tipping points and irreversible impacts that could send climate change spinning truly beyond our control. So far, we've experienced 1 degree Celsius of warming, and the impacts are frightening. One thing the Copenhagen Climate Conference agreed on is that a, quote, increase in global temperature should be below 2 degrees Celsius, unquote. If we're going to limit warming to 2 degrees, then we can emit at most 565 gigatons more of carbon dioxide. Burning the fossil fuel that corporations now have in their reserves would release 2,795 gigatons of carbon dioxide, nearly 5 times the safe amount. And every day, they're searching for more. Even though these assets are still underground, they are figured into their share prices. Companies are borrowing money against their reserves and basing their budgets on the presumed returns from them. It's why the big fossil fuel companies have fought so hard to prevent the regulation of carbon dioxide. These reserves are their primary asset, the holding that gives their companies their value. Their business model, extracting and burning all of these reserves, is incompatible with a livable climate. We need these companies to leave it in the ground, but how do we convince them to do so? Even as extreme weather events like Hurricane Sandy threaten to overwhelm local budgets, federal inaction to solve this crisis is all but stalled. We have the solutions, but we won't see any political progress on the issue until we can weaken the power of the fossil fuel industry. We cannot compete with the power of the industry financially. Divestment is a tactic for highlighting the destructive practices of the fossil fuel companies. By divesting, we send a message that we no longer accept their profiting from the extracting and burning of fuels that put our world at risk. Divestment would weaken the fossil fuel industry political standing and increase the chances of retiring its special breaks by taking away their social license to continue unchecked extraction. Of all the institutions that ought to be looking out for the public, the bottom line is this. Divestment is the only moral choice for governments that care about their citizens. Solving the climate crisis is the only practical choice for governments that care about their solvency. If it's wrong to wreck the climate, then it's wrong to profit from that wreckage. We believe that institutions that serve the public good, such as state government, should divest from fossil fuels. 200 publicly traded companies hold the vast majority of listed coal, oil, and gas reserves. These are the companies we're asking our institutions to divest from. Our demands to these companies are simple because they reflect the stark truth of climate science. They need to immediately stop exploring for new hydrocarbons. They need to stop lobbying in Washington and state capitals across the country to preserve their special breaks. Most importantly, they need the pledge to keep 80% of their current reserves underground forever. We want the Oregon Investment Council to freeze any new investment in fossil fuel companies and divest from direct ownership and any commingled funds that include fossil fuel public equities and corporate bonds within 5 years. On Monday, January 13th, the Eugene City Council unanimously voted to alter the city's investment strategy and divest of all Eugene's holdings in fossil fuel companies. The initiative was brought to the council by Mayor Kitty Pierce. In a speech for World Environment Day, Portland Mayor Charlie Hales urged the Oregon State Treasurer, the local government investment pools, and the Oregon Investment Council to divest of all state holdings in fossil fuels. If the Oregon Investment Council does not make the commitment to divest on its own, we'll be coming back here in a future session to ask you to tell them to do so. And I'll just close on a personal note. I'm old enough that I'm not going to see the worst of climate disruption. But as you can hear, I'm worried. I'm sorry. But I really do worry about the misery that awaits my two children, my two grandchildren, and my two grandnieces, not to mention all the other children of this world. I'm here today because I literally, want to save the world, and I hope to motivate you to understand the urgency of this task. It's my belief that all of us now, everywhere, must do all we can to turn this around and do it now. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Bailey and members of the committee, thank you for holding an informational meeting on divesting state funds from fossil fuels. I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you today. For the record, my name is Emily Lethenstrom. I reside at 4226 Southeast Pine Street in Portland. I'm here today as representing Portfolio 21 Investments as a senior research analyst. As momentum has gained across the globe for institutional and retail investors to divest of fossil fuel holdings, we see daily evidence of successful efforts toward this goal. In January, a group of 17 U.S. philanthropic foundations controlling $2 billion in assets committed to divesting of fossil fuel holdings and reinvest in clean energy. Organized as the Divest Invest Initiative, the coalition said they could no longer stay invested in the fossil fuel economy. Quote, when the climate science is clear that the window to preserve a livable climate is closing fast. In 2013, Storebrand ASA, which manages $74 billion in assets, sold 24 fossil fuel holdings to cut exposure to these risky assets. In addition, there have been numerous other examples of colleges, universities, cities, counties, religious institutions, and foundations who have committed to pursue fossil fuel divestment as they recognize the financial risk of staying invested in fossil fuels. At Portfolio 21, we have had a long-held rationale for not investing in fossil fuel companies. As part of our process to identify the most attractive long-term investment opportunities in the global public equity market, We research individual companies and industries in order to analyze specific risks and opportunities presented by environmental, social, and governance factors. Our process seeks to identify the global leaders that are most capable of thriving in the global economy of the future, and we find impressive companies in most industries and economic sectors. As fiduciaries for our clients and our shareholders, our discipline is to be inclusive in our research and objective in our findings. In our effort to select the best, we also seek to avoid those companies that are resisting the changes that are reshaping the economy, those that are involved in business activities that entail what we believe are unacceptable risks in environmental, social, or governance areas. As a result, our research has found unacceptable risks in fossil fuel exploration and production industry, and therefore we do not invest in companies in this sector. It is well known that burning fossil fuels releases carbon dioxide into the atmosphere and is the leading cause of global climate change. Atmospheric carbon dioxide levels are at record highs. Oil and gas production involves the routine venting and flaring of methane, which is a greenhouse gas with 25 times more global warming potential than carbon dioxide. Coal-fired power plants are currently the single largest source of carbon dioxide and account for one-third of all global emissions. There is currently no unifying global energy policy or carbon regulation, but global regulatory trends do not favor traditional fossil fuel energy sources. From the carbon tax in British Columbia to the regional greenhouse gas initiative in the northeastern U.S., regulatory and legislative changes have created pockets of uncertainty for fossil fuels. Collectively, they point to a grim future for fossil fuel companies where the assets of an entire industry may lose their value. Any international agreement on climate change targets could severely curtail extraction and consumption of fossil fuels. This could essentially render many hydrocarbon reserves unburnable or stranded, precipitating a massive drop in the assets and equity of extractive companies. If and when countries adopt carbon regulation or legislation to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, the fossil fuel industry could face increasing competition as new market opportunities for cleaner, renewable energy technologies develop. Currently, some technologies have reached technical maturity and are cost competitive with other energy sources when carbon dioxide values are taken into account. Coal, oil, and gas exploration and development have historically been responsible for large land disturbances, water contamination, air emissions, and other environmental impacts. As we all recall, the 2010 BP Deepwater Horizon oil rig explosion killed 11 men, released approximately 210 million gallons of oil into the Gulf of Mexico, and required 2 million gallons of chemical dispersants to break up the crude oil. In November 2012, BP agreed to pay $4.5 billion to settle a series of criminal claims related to the Deepwater tragedy. The Justice Department is also pursuing civil claims under the Clean Water Act and other statutes. Bloomberg News reports these fines could easily be in the tens of billions of dollars. Fossil fuel companies also face political risk when operating in countries with unstable political leadership or countries with a history of sudden nationalization. Also, civil unrest is a risk faced when operating in countries with oppressive regimes. For instance, the Niger Delta, where Shell, the federal government, and local communities have fought for decades. Over the years, Nigeria's high political risk manifested itself in the death of many civilians and the destruction of several Shell facilities. To date, high criminal activity exists, presenting Shell with security issues and the inability to attract top workers. As conventional sources of fossil fuels have become exhausted and technological advancements are made, the search for new reserves has moved into remote, pristine areas as well as densely populated communities. Unconventional fossil fuel development unequivocally increases operating costs on a per-barrel basis. Extreme operating conditions pose significant operating challenges and magnify environmental risks. Although the Arctic is estimated to contain 13% of the world's undiscovered oil reserves and 30% of gas reserves, the harsh climate and the limited availability of infrastructure make fossil fuel exploration a high-risk venture. In January of this year, Shell announced it would suspend plans to drill in the Arctic after facing delays due to sea ice and spending $5 billion in permits, personnel, and equipment since 2008. One does not need to be a climate activist to find unattractive aspects to investments in the fossil fuel industry. We believe that the long-term risk-reward profile of the sector is unattractive based on known risks within the current operating environment. Portfolio 21 believes it is possible to produce risk-adjusted returns that are competitive with appropriate broad benchmarks through a portfolio that does not invest in fossil fuel companies. In fact, we believe that it is preferable to avoid these companies because of their unattractive risk profile. It is important to note that approximately 8% of the global equity market is off limits to those who choose to divest, leaving 92% of the market available to a portfolio manager to meet their fiduciary responsibility. Divestment of fossil fuel stocks is not purely an investment strategy, but also a moral and a political one. Climate change is the greatest moral challenge of our time, affecting all of life on Earth, threatening every society and the natural systems on which they depend. As Albert Einstein said, quote, "Those who have the privilege to know have the duty to act." We understand it would take the state of Oregon many years to unwind its investments in both public and private fossil fuel holdings. Yet an investor in this situation may consider a prohibition on new fossil fuel investments, a commitment to unwinding existing investments in a manner not harmful to the state system participants, and investing in new fossil-free opportunities. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Christy Splitt, and I'm the External Affairs Director for the Oregon League of Conservation Voters. Today, I'm representing OLCV, but most of you know that I also coordinate the Oregon Conservation Network. And I just want to share a little bit about why all of us together here in Oregon that work on conservation issues deeply care about climate change. So, like I said, my job is to coordinate OCN, which means I work with conservationists of all kinds that work on all sorts of issues all over the state, whether it's folks that care most about land use on the coast, folks that are worried about canyons in the east, folks that are worried about water quality. Climate change is an issue that unites us all. For example, this session, one of our priorities is to do all we can to meet our greenhouse gas emission goals as the state of Oregon. That means bills that apply to the solar industry. You have a room full of folks from the solar industry behind us, or the Clean Fuels Program, which we passed a few years ago and are working to lift the sunset on, and we'll continue to work on that effort together as OCN. And I also just wanted to point out that we're in the middle right now of putting together a long-term agenda, and climate is one of the things that we, like I said, care about most, unites us all. And it's an issue that literally every single group that's working on these portions of our long-term agenda keep going, well, can I say that? It's about climate. And I keep saying, yep, it's a thread for all issue areas that relate to conservation work in Oregon. And I'm really excited to see the work of 350.org, volunteer-led. I don't think they have any paid staff in Oregon, and here they are having an informational meeting on the thing they care about most. I think that's pretty exciting, and I really want to make sure to save plenty of time for you to hear from folks that aren't in the building all the time like me. But I will just say this. Divestment is an incredibly important tool. It raises awareness of the need to change our investment strategies from fossil fuels to low-carbon ones. And it's exciting to see, like I said, a group doing the work, doing the lifting of talking to the treasurer, talking to legislators, talking to elected officials at the local level about what we can do to make that change right here. So I just want to say thank you to the group, and I'm really honored to be here to just remind everyone how important this particular issue is, climate change, to all of us that care about the environment in Oregon.
Thank you.
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Walt Eager. I reside at 3500 Northwest Glenridge Place in Corvallis. I represent 350.org Corvallis, but more importantly, I represent my three precious grandchildren and yours, whose futures are in great jeopardy because of fossil fuel use. Thank you for the opportunity to address this critically important issue. I served Oregon as an ODOT supervisory engineer. I earned my share in the PERS retirement system by helping make Oregon bridges safe for family and commercial travel. It was appalling to me to learn that my retirement funds have been invested in fossil fuel companies, enabling them to egregiously pollute the air my family breathes and your family breathes, the water we drink, the ground, streams, and ocean in which our food is grown. Simultaneously, fossil fuel exhaust gases increase atmospheric carbon dioxide, thus climate change. Former Oregon Secretary of State Bill Bradbury frequently delivers a presentation which explains the adverse effects of climate change is now having and will continue increasingly have on Oregon agriculture, fisheries, and many other Oregon industries. He explains that they are the lifeblood of the Oregon economy and consequently the employment of Oregonians. It is incomprehensible that funds belonging to Oregon retirees are being used to destroy the natural environment and the economy of the state in which we live and dutifully served for so many years. It is both ethically and economically imperative for PERS to divest from all fossil fuel securities. It is imperative that these funds be reinvested in clean and renewable energy companies, including those that have been and others that must be attracted to Oregon. This will create thousands of new jobs, high-paying jobs for Oregon employees. This PERS divestment and reinvestment will greatly improve the health and the physical and financial security for Oregon employees. This PERS divestment and thank you for letting me testify to this life-critical interest of your and my grandchildren and those who will follow them. This interest is the PERS replacement of fossil fuel investments with clean energy investments. Thank you.
Thank you. I just want to say that I appreciate that 350.org is a volunteer-led organization. You are all giving your time to a very critical issue, and I appreciate you making time to come down and present in front of the legislature. Particularly, I found the comments about risk profiles and investments interesting, and I appreciate you taking time to highlight this this critical issue for us. Are there questions from this panel for the committee, for this panel from the committee? Seeing none, it sounds like we have the information we require, and I appreciate it again. Thank you, and we'll, I'm sure, be discussing this again in the future. Thank you.
Thank you again, too.
Okay. We will close the informational meeting on climate responsible investments and open an informational meeting on report from Oregon solar industry. And I should say, for the folks in the audience, I should have said this earlier, if you see members coming and going, especially for folks who aren't in the building all the time, we are at the point in session in which many members have bills up in other committees at which they have to testify, and so we'll be going to perform other duties in other committees and coming back. Please don't take their coming and going as any reflection upon the testimony before the committee. So I just want to make sure that that is out there. I'd like to call up, please, David Brown, Kevin Keene, and Joe Esmond to kick us off, please. Mr. Brown, would you care to kick us off? I assume you're going first.
Yes, Chair Bailey, members of the committee. For the record, my name is David Brown. I live in Lake Oswego, Oregon, and I own Obsidian Renewables, an Oregon solar developer. I'm very happy to be before the committee today with other members of the Oregon solar industry to talk about where the industry is today and give a report and a snapshot on where we've come. So the first chart I have for you today is a chart on the costs of solar, the capital costs of installing solar. I should mention that my company specializes in larger scale projects, and we've made a deliberate decision to work in the sunny part of the state, and so these are the numbers that apply to larger scale projects located east of the Cascades. So in 2009, when we started, the cost of doing a solar installation was about $6.35 a watt. And I've given you the three principal components of that cost: panel prices, what's called the balance of system, that's the labor, the racking, the electrical wiring, etc., and then the soft costs and developer profit, legal fees, permitting, studies, etc. Next to that is the cost of doing that exact same project today. The price profile I'm giving you is for a project in Klamath County that we call Old Mill. A lot of attention has been given to the fact that panel prices have dropped, but what people don't appreciate as much is that the balance of system costs have fallen by about half, and the soft costs on larger scale projects have fallen by more than 75%. And a big reason for those reductions is the experience in Oregon and candidly in California in solar, that the once people get around the track, understand the processes, understand what the risks are, understand the unknowns and the uncertainties, these costs tumble. I use as an example legal fees, but the legal fees I budget for a project today are 10% of the legal fees on my first project. So that's an example of significant costs coming down due to experience. So the next thing I'd like to talk about is, how does this translate into electricity prices? So under Oregon's solar program, the utilities each would do a 500 kilowatt project a year. And 500 kilowatts is really the absolute smallest size of a larger scale project. So this is the first 500 kilowatt project in the Pacific Core Territory. In a competitive process, the price of the electricity from that project was 24 cents a kilowatt hour. Now, I've estimated the what I'll call the value of the electricity and the cost of the subsidy as being two components inside that 24 cent circle. For the cost of electricity, I used the retail price, 8.5 cents. This committee and others have asked that a solar resource value be determined, but that hasn't happened yet. So I'm using the retail price as a proxy. So the value of the electricity I'm using is 8.5 cents, and the subsidy in this project was 16 cents. This is a project we just completed in Lakeview, Oregon, in December. The circle has shrunk from being a 24-cent circle to being an 11-cent circle. Still the same thing, electricity. And the amount of the subsidy has dropped from 16 cents to 2.5 cents. Same size project, same technology, everything's pretty much the same. Then the next slide is, what if we made it bigger, and what would it be today? And so this is a 10 megawatt project, and you can see that the value of the subsidy is now approximately 0.5 cents. So it's dropped by well more than 90% in the last 4 years. And we can build solar in Oregon now for $90 per megawatt hour or less. That's 9 cents or less. And that's fixed for 20 years with a 2% annual escalator to cover the cost of inflation on the relatively modest operating costs. So there are a lot of reasons that Oregon solar prices have come down. They haven't just come down in Oregon. They've come down everywhere. But I wanted to explain to this committee that it's way beyond the panels. It's every element of that. And the industry in Oregon is committed to driving these costs down more. So we've selected a number of people from the Oregon solar industry to testify for you today. Everybody comes with their own perspective. Like I say, my perspective is larger projects, but we have people who will talk about the other parts of the industry as well. Thank you.
Dramatic graphs, Mr. Brown. Those are very interesting. Thank you. Please.
Representative Bailey and the committee. My name is Kevin Keene. I represent Solar World. And as you all know, I am happy to represent Solar World, the leader in the world in terms of innovation technology with solar. and it's right here in Oregon. Each and every day, in fact, in this 3.5 minutes that I'll be talking, we'll produce enough panels to supply 2 houses with enough energy from the solar panels that we produce. In regards to what David was talking about, bringing down costs, we're also happy to drive innovation right here with research and development out of Oregon, and in collaboration with our counterparts in Germany, we're able to substantially increase the amount of watts that we're getting out of each solar panel, and we continue to do that. All of that means that we're continuing to drive down the costs, like David was talking about, in terms of balance of systems, soft costs, and we're able to produce more and more energy each and every year. All of this is possible because of good policies by states, federal governments, and other agencies around the world. And I see this two different ways. I represent the 9 western states for Oregon. So the states that have good, strong solar policy are thriving in solar. But we also see this with countries around the world as well. I was stricken in 2013 that of all the countries, the Czech Republic jumped up dramatically in terms of their installed capacity virtually overnight. And it was because of some solar policies that they instituted. And you can look at the global picture worldwide, and it's because of that. So I want to come here and personally thank you for the efforts that you guys have done. Oregon, for being known as the cloudy state, we are leading the way in not only manufacturing, but we're also leading the way in terms of installed capacity for solar. Thank you.
Thank you.
Excuse me. Good afternoon, Chair Bailey, members of the committee. My name is Joe Esmond. I am a business agent for the IBW Local 48, and over the past 13 years have focused on renewable energy. I'm the old hippie in our industry that they said, hey, would you go look at this solar stuff? And I chased it, and I became part of the Energy Trust early on, realizing the opportunities for our trade. We view solar like we view, you know, it's another part, another facet of our industry. That being said, we've trained roughly 2,400 electricians, men and women, in the IBW here in the state of Oregon, throughout the state, through our 5 centers of training. Along the lines of the Energy Trust, early on, I arranged something with the Energy Trust. We got the panels to our training centers. You guys installed them free, gratis, for advertising. It was very successful. What we do is we train. We train not only for the installations, but a quality installation, a safe installation. You have to remember, solar panel is not one of these. It's an electrical device, and when you get bit, as we say, it hurts. So safety is very important to us. Figuring out if we can wire up high-tech industry, the dams, houses, wave, windmills, and the EV industry, which I've been part of also. And I've worked here in this building with my good friend, Representative Benz, my good friend, Representative Huffman, and you too, Jules. But I'm very frustrated. We have all these trained people, and the state of New Jersey, which has a bridge problem like we have a bridge problem, has more solar than we do. And I don't remember the square footage, acreage, miles of the other side of the mountains. You could probably fit Ohio in there. Maybe I exaggerate. So it's one of the highest solar resources in the whole country. So I urge you strongly to change the policies, make it easier for this to be done. And Kevin knows this, but it'd be great to have Solar World have more work here. I mean, it's like having an oil industry not have an oil facility in their own state. That being said, one more thing about the fossil fuels. I hearkened, which I don't use that often, but very surprised to see years ago that when the oil companies got into the solar business as a subsidiary, said, oh, shoot, this is going to take off. It's sort of taken off here, but we can do a lot more in this state, and I urge you to push for these policies. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks to the panel for all of your work in my part of the state, our efforts out there. I'm interested, though, in knowing what you see as the barrier that's stopping this from happening. Price is down. What is it that's the biggest thing standing between Oregon and more of this type of energy?
Chair Bailey, Representative Benz, thank you. At the conclusion of this hearing, I think we'll end by saying that announced that we're starting a policy group to begin meeting now. We'd like to report to you in the interim with a view towards having some proposals for legislation in 2015, and that'll be a big part of that focus. But initially, I thought the issues were around land use, and we did a lot of work on removing and establishing some solar rules for land use, especially in kind of hardscrabble grazing land in eastern Oregon. We got that done, but it didn't really cause the big projects to come forward. I have recently begun to spend a lot more time with the Oregon Public Utility Commission, and it's a very slow place to develop policy. And I think that there is going to need to be some leadership from the legislature directing what would we like to see and what kind of policies we'd like to see come forward. So part of it is knowledge. I mean, a big part of the reason for this meeting is we're trying to get the word out that it's not as expensive as the Oregonian says. And so we're trying to get the word out that costs have come down, they're still coming down, they're going to continue to come down, and there are a lot of good reasons for that, including the technology advancements that Kevin talked about. A panel that used to produce 195 watts produces 280 watts today, same size panel. That really cuts down labor costs. That really cuts down wiring costs. It reduces the amount of land you need by a third. I mean, there are a lot of advances that are occurring. And we're way behind the curve on knowledge. That's a big part of it.
Please. I have a follow-up with Joe.
Yeah. I'm way behind the policy.
You want to have a pure climate? It's going to have, I mean, you know what? You want to do the right thing and get off these fossil fuels. To me, it's like a no-brainer. Right over Cliff Benz's, Representative Benz's here, is huge. A megawatt is about the size of a football field, straight. Okay, so that gives you the idea how many football fields, once you go past Sun River and keep going east, there's a lot of football fields out there. We got to do better. I mean, even in California, I just came from a meeting. It was in Phoenix last week, damn it. I had to do it on business, you know. NRG, they're doing huge solar projects across the country. They can put 250 megawatts in California, in the in the desert, and figure out a way to do that. Well, what the hell? We can do the same thing here.
Please.
David, the challenge, it seems to me, is if you have a fairly flat demand for energy, then these opportunities are going to be fairly modest. Otherwise, you have to bring it in as a replacement for something that we already have, such as coal or natural gas or water. We're not going to replace the water. So at least coal and natural gas as the generators that would have to be replaced. If this state chose to, as the previous panel suggested, get out of the coal generation business and replace it with solar, pretty big number, I'm guessing. Studies in California suggest that the most that ratepayers would pay would be an additional 9% on their bills over what they're currently paying. And so if we were going to replace coal, could we do it for that amount? Has anyone actually looked at what the cost would be of that, which we just heard the previous panel suggest we should do.
Chair Bailey, Representative Benz, I'll put this on the record, and you can ask me in 4 months if it turned out that I was right or wrong. I think that we can replace 300 megawatts of Boardman coal with 300 megawatts of solar at a rate impact that's not more than 1.5% on the bill. This is a sunny state, and it's not based on what solar cost 2 years ago, which is what a lot of the reports are telling you. It's based on what solar is going to cost 2 years from now. And you remember the 2016 date, it's approaching. That's when the investment tax credit drops from 30% to 10%. There are a lot of people on both sides of the aisle that think that the solar industry will get what the wind industry got, which is not that it has to be done in 2016, but it has to be started in 2016. And started means actual work. And so you can't start if land use laws prohibit you from starting. But it looks like we have a little more time to capture some of that investment tax credit. And yes, I think we can do it. We can do that much solar for that kind of a rate impact.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Brown, thanks for being here. I appreciate your testimony, too. Because the type of projects you're talking about, from my perspective, are where we need to go as a state. If we're going to be serious about trying to create electricity, if that's our motivation for in having solar panels subsidized, have them installed, have them wired in whatever capacity, that's where the bang for the buck is. I'm much less enthusiastic about putting them on rooftops throughout Portlandia, if you will, because that just isn't where the resource, that isn't where we're going to recognize and realize the value. So could you just maybe talk a little bit about the ease of installation, just from the application standpoint, with the projects you do, which are on, how high off the ground are they? Not very far.
No.
Versus climbing on a 2 or 3 story rooftop that has a variable pitch, where you have to make penetrations through a roof that are going to require maintenance over time, and just a lot of extrapolating circumstances there. And one of the reasons why I'm guessing your soft costs have gone down is because you're in a predictable playing field. It's much more easy to gauge to bid your type of work than going to someone's home who says, I would like to, you know, install X number of kilowatts or whatever of power. So could you just talk about the ease of installation? And then from Joe's perspective, from the labor standpoint, you guys have got to love to stand on the ground rather than get on a ladder and climb on somebody's roof to do that kind of work.
December on the other side of the mountains. They move faster, so maybe that's David.
Chair Bailey, Vice Chair Johnson, I think everyone on the committee understands that because of the driver of income tax incentives, if something has to be done by the end of the year, something has to be done by the end of the year. And our Lakeview project that I illustrated on my slides was finished, as I said, in December. But we had some of Joe's guys out there at 20 below zero working with nuts. It was cold. 15 minutes on the job, 15 minutes in the trailer. But anyway, seriously, to answer your question, Representative Johnson, there is a lot that's been done, and you'll hear from the rooftop people here shortly, but there's a lot that's been done in driving down costs of rooftop solar, and there's a lot more we can do in that area. Some very interesting work has been done here in Oregon in studying Germany, and why is it so much less expensive to put panels on the roofs in Germany? Obviously, Solar World is quite expert in that, and they've been part of that whole discussion. And Oregon is participating in a Solar Cities program, looking at permitting costs, approvals, and again, trying to, why are we doing it this way? What can we do that's faster, easier, and more efficient? I think all that work is necessary. I think it's extremely important. I think that we should be committed in all areas of solar to drive down costs. I have a solar system on my house, not because it's necessarily economic, but That's what I chose to do, and in this country you can make those decisions. And so I celebrate solar wherever it is. But in terms of doing a lot of climate impact at the lowest possible subsidy, you need to have those bigger projects. They need to be part of the picture. I think we'll continue to have rooftop solar, and I think it's pretty exciting, but in Oregon, too many of the rooftops are in the cloudier area. And in a lot of eastern Oregon, some of the construction is just not designed to put a 25-year solar project on the roof. It just isn't that kind of a roof. It doesn't have that much of a life left in it. It wasn't designed to carry those loads and wind. And so there are more challenges in rooftop, but it definitely, in my view, plays a role.
If I may.
Please.
I would say we hear the ads on the TV from the fossil fuel industry. All of the above approach. I would say that in terms of renewable energy, the all of the above approach is correct, excluding fossil fuels, of course. So that would definitely include rooftop solar in Germany. Pig farmers have solar. Homeowners have solar. Everywhere has solar. In terms of the cost, the other benefit of putting solar on top of the rooftop, just like growing food in your own garden, is that you're connected to that source. When you're connected to the actual energy that you're producing, you're going to become much more aware of the energy that you're using. So one of the side benefits that we see as an industry is that when people put solar on top of their roof, whether it be a business or a home, they're much more cognizant of the actual energy that they're producing and trying to narrow that gap to a net zero as much as possible. So we get a kind of a dual benefit. In terms of the industry, I think that it's important that we have policy that makes it possible for not just large commercial, but also utility and residential in terms of industry. And the solar industry is definitely committed to driving down costs in all of the areas. So it's not just, hey, we're asking for subsidies, but we're actually looking for ways. How can we improve? How can we improve our efficiencies? How can we work with local jurisdictions to reduce some of the soft costs? And all of those things together will help provide our energy portfolio.
Representative Leininger.
Thank you. I think it's really exciting that we're talking about larger scale solar facilities, and as a newcomer to this committee, I have a fair amount to learn. So since it's an informational meeting, I wanted to ask you if there are substantial barriers to the scaling up of commercial solar, larger scale solar projects in the form of transmission and storage barriers. Can solar be stored long term? Does it need to be used as generated? Do we have transmission difficulties if we're generating on the eastern part of the state, but most of our consumers are on the west part of the state? And if either of those things is true, what kind of capital investment needs would be part of scaling up major solar projects, which I do think are an exciting idea?
Chair Bailey, Representative Leininger. So the easier question to answer is about storage. There is no cost-effective way today to store electricity produced by solar or by another means. There's a huge amount of work being done in universities and thought centers. PGE is involved in kind of an exciting storage project down in Salem. It's definitely coming. It's just not cost-effective yet. With respect to transmission, candidly, that goes back to what I touched on earlier about there being a knowledge gap. It's extremely hard for somebody like me to learn where the transmission system is available and where the transmission system is constrained. You have to go through a FERC deliberative type process to ask your question and find out, and there just isn't any place where you can go and find out, well, this is an area where there's available transmission and this is an area where there isn't. Because a lot of people have done a lot of work, there's some kind of common knowledge that the gorge and the area all the way to Boardman is heavily constrained because all the wind projects coming down that corridor, and the BPA is doing work on expanding that capacity now. But in Representative Benson's district, which I've been all over, you know, we stop and pull over the side of the road and go over to the pole and try to figure out how big the wire is on the pole because it's just hard to get that information. I think that the kind of solar I'm talking about is not a 300 megawatt project. It's 30 10 megawatt projects scattered throughout the state, each serving the area in which it's located, so that long distance transmission isn't as necessary. And as a result of those projects being where they are, then that frees up power that can move down the gorge system and to PG service territory. That's simplistic, but that's the general idea.
Representative Boone, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And David touched on what I was going to mention, is the trend seems to be, maybe not just in solar, but in a lot of other sectors, smaller, more community-based projects. So they're more closely, you know, and they also then answer the question of why are we developing all these big producing, you know, electric producing projects and then sending it to some other state where we take the risk, et cetera. So I think that having sat on the Solar Siting Task Force, I think we need to get that with you, and we need to get that report out again and look at it, because that was kind of precursor to some of the action this committee took last couple sessions in size of siting areas, and with Representative Benz's tiny little district where he lives, 19 million acres, you know, having to struggle to try to get to 1,000 acres was, I just thought it was unbelievable, and we ended up with, what, 250 or something like that. But I think that getting some of these smaller projects out there on the ground and working and having people benefiting from them is the way to go. And I'm a firm believer. I wish we weren't ending the Betsy and the Retsy and all that. I just wish that we could just get to renewables for people for in smaller increments as soon as possible. Because, I mean, and I have to bring it in. I started to sound like a former rep who always started as a former whatever, but as someone who works in emergency preparedness, lives on the coast, and I'm personally not living in the tsunami zone, but a lot of my friends and constituents are, we're looking how we can prepare for these events. And the biggest elephant in the room is getting our energy systems back up. And the resilience plan and everything is leaning toward, you know we have more time to do it than we have, or we need more time to do it than we have the capacity to wait that long. The 72 hour period of getting back up and running again is a farce. But that's the number one recommendation by the 170 member committee who made the plan, and now the 40 some or so member committee who's putting it in or implementing this plan. And the report will come out in October to this body, so we'll be able to see that. But I think I'm comfortable, and like you're comfortable in saying, we'll come to you in 4 months and see if you're right or whatever. I'm comfortable saying that that's the top thing, is to get locally developed energy systems, especially in these hit areas. They're going to be, we're going to be off of our transmission, general transmission lines for years. Our roads are going to be out for 3 to 4 years. And if we can get our buildings assessed and people back in and kids back to school and businesses back up and running while we recover, which will be slower, I think we'll be a lot better off. And this is something I've been waiting for the prices to go down too, because I've toured Solar World and I thought that's on my bucket list to do for my house. So keep working on that.
Thank you. Representative,
I'm out of planning to ask my question.
All right, Representative Peters.
Thank you, Chair. So I think everybody on the committee really likes solar because we have lots of questions for you, and I know we have other panels coming, but I just wanted to mention that one of the tours that I did was IBEWs, and it was wonderful to see in the training location that there were specific, rooms set up for solar, for electric cars, and I think one of the most exciting things in how Oregon can be a leader with using renewable technology and specifically solar is that it's a great opportunity for technology development and for job development, and we're in a great position to have that, this economic driver of the state also be a part of the kind of the research and the education and workforce training. And that's just great to see. So.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate your time. And I think it's a great panel to have manufacturers, installers, developers all here talking about the progress that we've made. It's dramatic in a short amount of time, and I think it's inspiring to this committee to hear about it and to think about the policies that we can do to continue to clear the barriers to allow for innovation to continue. And it's nice to be in that position as opposed to having to be in a position of having to prop something up. It's more about getting out of the way, it seems like. So we appreciate your time and look forward to subsequent panels.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair.
Sarah Friel, please. Brendan McCarthy and Ryan Mayfield. Ms. Friel, would you care to begin?
Sure.
Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Sarah Friel, and I have been working in the Oregon solar industry for the past 11 years. I spent my first 7 years working at Mr. Sun Solar in Portland as a installer, and I installed a couple hundred rooftop systems. And 2009, I got together with three other people and founded Synchro Solar. And we've been in business for the past 4 years. I've been a co-owner, and since I've been there, I've worked in marketing, sales, project management, and installation. Synchro Solar is a small company. We employ 6 full-time people. We install systems ranging in size from 3 kilowatts to 40 kilowatts. Over the past few years, we've installed approximately 30 systems per year for a total yearly install capacity of about 225 kilowatts. Approximately 50% of these projects have been residential. The other 50% have been small commercial. We've found a special niche in the farmers market. All across Oregon, we've found that small farmers love solar. They love 10 to 50 kilowatt projects. It makes sense to them. We've installed ground-mounted systems, roof-mounted systems in counties all across the state. So we've made a lot of progress there with farmers. Since 2003, I've seen total installed system costs decrease from about $10 per watt to now under $5 a watt for many systems, both residential and commercial systems. I've seen fall below $4 a watt. We're actually approaching $3 per watt for some commercial systems. The reason for this is not only, like Kevin from Solar World said, the decline in panel costs, that's certainly been significant, but also the Oregon industry as a whole has just gotten more experienced. We've gained a lot of ground with a lot of the programs, incentive programs that we've had over the past decade. It is so much easier to work with inspectors and people from permitting departments. Our subcontracting costs have declined from draftsmen, engineers, electrical subcontractors. Everybody's getting more experience, and their costs are coming down, and it's making installation costs come down. Public awareness and support for solar makes acquiring new projects easier. That lowers marketing costs for us. It's attractive state incentives make new companies come to Oregon, such as Synchro Solar. We opened in 2009 when we had the Betsy, and the feed-in tariff came a year later. And new companies equals more competition, and more competition drives down the cost. Local vendors such as Platt Electric, North Coast Electric, they have begun stocking all the materials that we need for installations, from panels to inverters to conduit and wire. So now we no longer have to pay shipping costs. We buy our 90% of our panels come from Solar World, so they're produced in Oregon. We buy them at Platt Electric. All the money stays here in Oregon. And incentives such as the feed-in tariff have driven our average system size up. We last year, 2013, 56% of our projects were 10-kilowatt feed-in tariff projects. Like I said, farmers love these 10-kilowatt feed-in tariff projects. And instead of, you know, in trying to get to 200 kilowatts install capacity in order to pay our bills every year, doing this in 3-kilowatt increments versus 10-kilowatt increments is much harder. So, yeah, making systems larger helps us and, you know, further drives down the cost. These systems are just more efficient. The labor costs, it takes about 4 days to install a 5-kilowatt system or a 10-kilowatt system, so might as well be 10. At Synchro Solar, we consider 2013 to be our most successful year, not because we installed more systems or because we made more money, but just because we are now a more experienced, mature company. We've gained a lot of ground. We've streamlined our installation and sales and marketing. We've really grown, and now we hope to continue to grow. We don't want to lose our momentum. We're hoping to have a successful feed-in tariff round again in April, and after that, we're kind of missing a commercial incentive. We can hang in there until 2015, but we really do need a long-term, stable incentive in 2015 to keep us going. So I ask you to please support solar and help us continue to be successful. Thank you.
Appreciate the perspective.
Sir. Chair Bailey, rest of the committee, my name is Ryan Mayfield. I represent Renewable Energy Associates and president down in Corvallis. And as well, I serve as a part-time instructor at Lane Community College. So I am the solar PV instructor down in our energy management program down in Eugene. And among the many hats I tend to wear in the solar industry, one of the ones that I'm very passionate about and here to talk to you about today is the training aspect of the individuals we've been training here in Oregon. I've been lucky enough to be involved nationally, internationally even, in some trainings, and the work we've been doing here in Oregon has been very fun and very effective, as I've seen working with the installers throughout the through the industry. I've been able to work with Joe's group, the IBEW, the IEC, so we've been working as a collaborative force along with OSEA, Oregon Solar Energy Industries Association, to help train as many individuals as we possibly can in solar installations. I personally began training in 2006 and at Lane Community College, and it's been great to see a number of my former students at LCC have gone on working in the industry here in Oregon, and so it's been a very nice thing to see them be able to come out and find the work that they're after after going through school for a couple years. Another part of what we do, what I am involved in, is at the apprenticeship training committee. So we have an apprenticeship program for renewable energy technicians, and so we're working with them trying to make sure that they get the proper training through as many avenues as we possibly can. And in the past, OSEA has been very heavily involved in trainings, and we're going to continue doing that as we move forward here in the next few years. Part of what has made, I would say, Oregon so successful in terms of training individuals has been the previous programs, the previous incentive programs we've had that have enabled numerous systems going in. Companies like Sarah's have been able to install systems have been able to apply the knowledge that they're learning. The students that I'm teaching at LCC, the apprentices that are learning in the classroom, but they're taking all that knowledge that they're learning in the classroom in the field and helping drive down the costs of installed solar, whether it be on a 3-kilowatt system or on David's 5-megawatt system. So we're taking those same principles and applying them to help drive down those costs. OSTIA, as I mentioned, is very actively engaged in the training. We are currently offering continuing education credits, so we are targeting installers, both solar installers and electricians, enabling them to get continuing education credits, National Electrical Code, continuing ed best practices for installing solar on all sizes systems. And then we're also planning this Oregon Solar Energy Conference, which we've done in the past and we'll be doing again this year to train as many individuals as we possibly can. So moving forward, you know, having a highly trained workforce is, in my opinion, you know, imperative in having the systems reduce costs, which is a very important, in reducing first costs, very important part of the overall picture, but also, as Jill mentioned, having a safe and reliable system. If we have these individuals trained properly, then we're going to ensure that we're having a long-term solution. So thank you for your time and your attention to our solar industry.
Thank you. Mr. McCarthy. Switch with you, sir.
Members of the committee, my name is Brendan McCarthy. I'm a state government affairs specialist at PGE. I've seen many of you before. Good to see you all again. I'm going to give you a snapshot from the utilities perspective. I'm the only utility on the panel, and I was struggling with trying to figure out where the utility fits in the solar industry. And I think, you know, sometimes we're a consumer. Sometimes we're an actual producer. We build our own panels or our own projects. Sometimes our customers are installing them, so we're an integrator. We're a provider of information. We play a very different role than a lot of other members of the solar industry. And ultimately, PGE has 835,000 customers in a compact 4,100 square mile service territory that we have to provide reasonably priced, safe, reliable power to on a non-discriminatory basis every day. So with that, I'm fairly certain that we're probably the only panelist that performs any sort of long-term planning to determine how we're going to serve our customers. And we're engaged in that right now, filing our integrated resource plan for 2013 in March next month. As part of that, we've done some looks at solar to figure out where is the solar picture going in Oregon. And I'm sure when we look into our crystal ball, we can only be assured of one thing, that we're probably going to be wrong. But we do it anyway. And so this graph that you see shows one such look over the planning horizon, getting us to 2033, which is the 20-year planning horizon that we have to look at. We're at about 49.7 megawatts now. That includes all distributed generation and utility scale coming into our system. As we move through on the low prediction, that's continuing at a residential rate of about 700 residential installs every year in a service territory. That's about what we're doing on average right now. That's the low prediction. The medium prediction is 700 residential installs and a return to sort of the Betsy era-like for commercial systems of about 4 megawatts installed a year. The high prediction adds on a 2.5-megawatt distributed utility scale system, a community scale project in our service territory every year on top of that 4. So those are the lines that you see there. Now the important factor for us is that it's a 12% capacity factor in our service territory, so that 266 megawatts equates to somewhere around 32 actual megawatts of energy. And our average daily load is about 2,700, 2,800 megawatts. Our peak load on a very hot or very cold day is about 3,900. So we've got some challenges there if we're looking at using solar to meet our load. From our IRP, in the winter, solar provides relatively low overall energy and it's not a good match to our peak load requirements. We're expected to remain a winter peaking utility throughout the planning horizon. And though in the summertime, energy generation is much higher, it still doesn't match our peak loads. So I just want to give you that that picture from the planning perspective. We did another survey of rooftop and looked at eligible rooftop in our service territory, a scoping analysis. We wanted to know what the technical potential was to bring solar in. What we found were, where we assessed all eligible roof space and brownfield ground sites in our service territory, including residential, commercial, and industrial, and public structures. We used fixed-mounted systems, and we based it on current commercialized efficiencies of about 12%. What we found is that the total technical distributed PV potential is about 1,300 megawatts in our service territory, and that equates to about 155 average megawatts at a 12% capacity. We make no assumptions about the economic attractiveness of this or what which systems may actually get sited, but that's what we view as the technical potential inside our service territory. Our share of Boardman is now 460 megawatts, which at about an 82% capacity factor is 383 megawatts. There's a significant difference there. With all due respect to Mr. Brown from the previous panel, that's a significant amount of solar that would have to be integrated into our system to replace Boardman, our share of it. So the other thing that we do is we profile our customers and we find out, what do these people look like? Well, on a residential solar customer profile, most of those people are affluent and highly educated. I don't think that's a particular surprise. Most of them have a graduate degree. They're dual income earners. They're high consumers of information. They're engaged with PG on a high level. Many of them are also Green Power Program participants. They're long-term PG customers. They're registered on a website. They look at their accounts on our website. And the single-family homes that they own are worth a fair amount, $300,000 with about half of that in equity. So most of our residential solar customers are doing fairly well, and they're fairly well off. Now, if we're going to try and hit other folks with a solar program, I think we need to consider who's using the current ones, and that's who's using it now. So where are we at? We're doing, I think, fairly well. This is as of December last year. You can see from that pie chart that there is slightly more commercial installed systems. That makes sense. They're slightly larger on a capacity basis. The SPO, or the feed-in tariff, we call it the SPO, solar payment option. The systems are also, on average, a little bit larger. But we're up to about 40 megawatts of installed capacity and 4,300 customers. And we're trundling along at about 9 megawatts a year in DC capacity added to that total. That's the distributed part. On the utility scale, PGE has met its House Bill 3039 from 2009 solar PV capacity standard requirement with the systems that you see on the screen. They are virtually all PPAs, but that's where we're at. When you convert the 13.4 to AC, we've met the standard. And that's a quick picture. The picture at the bottom is the Baldock rest area we installed, I think, in 2012. Came online, maybe in early 2013. It's about 1.75, 1.8 megawatts. You can see that when you drive by. If you go into the rest area and the backside, you can see it yourself. And today, I think I want to use the opportunity to officially announce that we have received management and board approval to finally get our solar shares model off the ground. And we're pretty excited about this. We still have a lot of development to go, but ultimately this is a project that we plan to put at our Bethel substation just east of Salem. I think that dotted, the red and white dashed line just south of Bethel there is, I think, State Street, and you see 50th on the map, so relatively close into Salem, and it would be inside the fence line at Bethel. What we anticipate is a community scale project where people can, on an affinity style basis, like with Green Power, sign up to receive a block of solar from a specific project that they can go and see. Other utilities around the country have done this with varying degrees of success, but we think with 13% or so of our customers enrolled in Green Power program, we have a customer base that's willing and interested in this type of model. part of the additional fee that they would pay would be reinvested in making sure that these projects could be replicable. We would be pulling money from our renewable development funds, which come from the existing Green Power programs and probably the ETO. So there's some more conversations there, but we're excited about it. So I just want to conclude. I think any discussion of solar in Oregon has to include discussion of cost, and I think we've done a good job of that today. But cost and who pays those costs. Fundamentally, we're dealing with a resource that still is more expensive on an energy-generated basis than virtually any other available to a utility. While costs have come down dramatically in years, and we're seeing about a 6 to 10% reduction every year, we continue to worry about the subsidies that many of our customers provide so that a few of our customers can install solar on their homes. We need to ensure that any program that we design provides incentives for solar that don't unfairly shift costs from participating customers to not from non-participating customers. This is an evolving marketplace. Technologies and costs are changing on a rapid basis, and I think that if we want to answer where we're going to go, if we want to install more in the state, who pays the above market costs, and for how long? I think we need to recognize, as some people have said today, and as the data shows, we're not doing badly in Oregon. In 2012, we were 15th in the country for installed capacity. We added 27 megawatts of solar that year. There are 10 states currently at what we would consider to be retail parity, where the retail price of the utility in the local area is the same as the power being generated from a utility-scale system. There are probably 12 other states that are on the bubble of that happening. Oregon's probably beyond that, but within a reasonable timeline, probably in the 2016 timeframe, we see retail grid parity happening in Oregon, certainly on a utility scale and maybe down to a commercial scale. So when we design future programs, we have to consider what we can see right now, and that's costs declining to that point. So we're actively exploring ideas like solar shares, which will enable our customers to install more PV, put more PV into their energy mix, have it in a fashion that avoids unfair cost shifts. We're working with some commercial-sized customers, some public customers to design ways that PGE can help them put solar on the rooftops. And that's it. That's my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you.
I have a quick question for Sarah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was looking at your website here, and there's a couple of projects that show this one has, I think, 9 or 10 panels on a home.
Sure.
And does that power the house and send some back to the grid?
You know, it all depends on how much power the home consumes. So our systems can supply anywhere from 20% to 100% of a home or a business's power.
It was, you know, there's another one on a house that's got twice as many panels. It looks like a little bit bigger house, but just, and I know that you can't give a hard and fast answer, but just Joe Citizen, you know, doesn't leave all the lights on all the time and doesn't run the dryer constantly.
So my house, I live in an 1,800 square foot house in Portland. There's 5 adults living there. I have a 5-kilowatt system, solar world panels on my roof, and it supplies about 85% of my power.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then just follow up, quick follow up. Do, and maybe Brendan, because you're the utility in the, well, in, at the dais, there's more utility folks in the back here now. And how, you know, when your customers who use these newer power, renewable power sources, are they net metering, I mean, at that point, or how many are, is that common, or what's the mix there?
Can we put that back up? So the top number is our net metered residential and commercial, and then the feed-in tariff is the next number in that first block.
Okay, got it. The SPO is the feed-in tariff.
Feed-in tariff.
Okay. Okay, thanks.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you. Mr. McCarthy, I'm really interested in what the primary barriers are in getting from where we are right now in terms of the proportion of our energy that's generated from renewable sources and to getting to a future point. And I'm wondering what you see as a utility that has to deal with reliable distributed power supply. What you see as the main main impediment to rapid scale up is storage and transmission capacity a huge issue? Because it seems to me that if we're going to use more solar or wind, even that the gaps problem that I assume you face in what to do during those times when the wind isn't blowing or the sun's not shining, or it's shining in the east but not in the west, you know, those are big barriers. If the state were to do capital investments or incentives to propel the renewable sector forward, should we be looking closely at those barriers, or does it make sense to look at, in equal measure, at, you know, various kinds of sources, which is, I think, how I see some of the conversation we've had here.
Hi, Representative Bailey and Representative Munger. It's a complicated question. I think at the current rate of penetration that we're seeing, we believe that the install rate is manageable within the system. Obviously, we are, as you point out, dealing with a variable resource. David Brown also pointed out our Salem Smart Power Center, which, along with it's a battery storage facility, along with some advanced controls, some ability to turn off and actually island a 5-megawatt load center in Salem, combining that with on-site generation of solar, distributed standby generation from diesel generators, reduction in thermostatic load from some residential participants, and demand management there. That entire center can serve that 5 megawatts of load for 15 minutes. While we were engaged in building that center, the battery manufacturer that we dealt with went bankrupt. We did complete the facility, however, but it's an indication of the challenges. We got money from the RA stimulus fund to do it. It's a success story, but I don't mean to take anything away from it, but it is a picture into the limitations that are involved in something like mass quantities of storage. I am not a transmission expert. I have been recently talking with some of the people who deal with our interconnection requests and our paths from the east side. I do understand that they are relatively constrained in a transmission capacity front for solar coming over from the east side. Part of that also is an expense. There are needs to, depending on where the solar system is, they may need to wheel across several territories, which adds expense to bringing the power in at an economic basis for PGE. So that's a consideration. It's a complicated question, and it's a complicated answer. I don't think there's one thing. I think it's, we're seeing what we believe to be a good rate of install at this point in time in our service territory.
It would be interesting to talk more about it going forward.
Thank you. Representative Benson, I do want to note that we have one more panel, and I'd like to make sure that we give them sufficient time to get their testimony in.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Extremely simple question for Brendan. So the concept of solar power was driven in large part by the RPS. The RPS driven in large part by the desire to have lower carbon emissions. The question I have is, how do we do the cost-benefit analysis in determining where we should invest this money? Because one might argue that these investments would do far more good in China if we just sent the money over there and replaced one of their coal-fired plants. Or something, because when I look at the 11 million kilowatts per day or megawatts per day burned in the United States, I see 37 here for solar. It doesn't seem to compute except in the little house we built for ourselves in the form of the RPS. So my question is, is your company suggesting or thinking that we ought to be looking at a broader scale on the return on investment, such as what you're providing here? Because if the measure is just meeting the RPS, that's one thing. But if the measure is true impact on carbon creation, is this the best way to do it? And I'm not so much asking for your opinion, because I'm asking for, when you go into the PUC and you're suggesting this is what you're going to do, what are the measures applied, and can we do a better job here in suggesting to the PUC what those measures should be?
Sounds like a one-sentence answer, I would assume, given the complexities of different funding sources and jobs benefits and all those kinds of things.
Representative Benz, Representative Bailey, Chair Bailey. We engage in this integrated resource planning process to figure out where our energy is going to come from over the next 20 years. We put in a five-year action plan for resources that are on the larger side, 20 megawatts and larger. For the smaller projects, where it makes sense, where it's a prudent decision, we are looking at those opportunities. That is not... in no respect directly related to the renewable energy standard. Where the systems make sense, where they are cost-effective, we look at solar as an available resource to meet our energy needs.
Thank you.
Thank you. I would imagine there's probably others in the audience who would like to speak to the jobs benefits of the RES, but we'll leave that debate for another time. Thank you to this panel. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I'd like to call up Shannon Souza, Paul Israel, and Jeff Bissonette, please. Ms. Souza, would you care to begin?
Sure.
Thank you.
First of all, I wanted to thank you for gathering, and also in addition to your time, for clearly what is an open-minded contemplation of just how we as a state are to balance our energy portfolio. And in addition to the RPS, bringing up what Representative Boone so eloquently referred to in her home district. I'm from Coos Bay, and we definitely do sit on a subduction zone, and a 72-hour power outage is nothing. That's very frequent. So I do know and hopefully can compel you to see that solar does play a viable and essential role in the resiliency of our homes, our communities, and our states.
And if you could please state your name for the record, that would be
great. My name is Shannon Souza.
I'm
the owner and founder of Soul Coast Consulting and Design. I've lived in Oregon State for 20 years. For the last 15 years, I've had a private practice. My background is in mechanical and environmental engineering. I have a stated mission of supporting strategic growth, responsible development, and sustainable living in Oregon, specifically in coastal communities. The name of the company is Soul Coast. I've got a peace symbol surrounded by a sunshine on my sleeve, so that kind of tells you where I'm headed.
With Joe.
Having said that, though, we are a full-service sustainability consulting and contracting firm, and that is important because we're often called in by tribal entities, new homeowners or builders, and municipalities to find out what they can do to increase their own resiliency in the event of a disaster, to reduce their overhead costs, and to make them feel better about the life or the business that they are leading. They're not necessarily calling us in for solar. They're looking for solutions. And over the past 10 years, increasingly, the answer has been solar. It's readily available. We can accurately predict what kind of productivity we're going to get out of it. I won't talk about all of the technology prices going down as much as that's already very adequately been covered. But for us as the rooftop contractors, if you will, we go from our first install in 2003 was the first grid-tied system in Coos County of 3 kilowatts. More recently, we had a 90-kilowatt install that was funded wholly through Pacific Power Blue Sky and Energy Trust for our Head Start building. We have grown from a mom-and-pop, run-from-home engineering and contracting business to Main Street, heavily involved in our downtown association business that is very viable. We are an IBEW electrical contractor. That's very important because that has enabled us to rise to the occasions when RF funds come through and successfully bid and implement larger scale projects. This is important because when we can take 9 licensed journeymen and put them through 100 subsequent one after the other installs, we were able to reduce our installation time over the duration of that one project by 20%. We've been able to take those learnings forward to any installation. Further, we were able to hit a 15% very aggressive target in waste materials. And a lot of that comes from the soft costs associated with coordinating with our delivery and working with our suppliers like Solar World. They have engineers on staff, and if we want to, we can contact them, shoot them a photograph of and some dimensions of the roof, and they can plug and play a nice, tight, tidy, bundled system that doesn't have wasteful racking that we're cutting off and additional materials that we have to turn around and recycle. So these are little nuances, but the point is that your rooftop solar professionals and installers are continuously sharpening our pencils. And as an industry, my company and all of my colleagues around the state and within OSEA are all engaged in continuous improvement. So I wouldn't say that we're fully matured, but we're definitely stepping into our stride, and it really would be a shame for something to trip us up, specifically in the area of commercial financial leveraging tools. The void of the Betsy is vast and a little bit scary as we look forward. I did also want to talk more about some of the technological breakthroughs that have expanded our market. In my market, increasingly, we are being approached by residential and business owners that do want to have a system that will operate during a power outage. As has been mentioned, the issue with storage, it's very expensive. Typically on a residential or a moderately sized commercial system, we're looking at another $10,000 that doesn't have subsidies associated with it. We've had two breakthroughs that are starting to change that. One is an inverter that is a standard grid-tied inverter that does supply a modest amount of AC power during a power outage without backup batteries when the sun is shining. That's very, very valuable to someone like myself who lives 11 miles up the river and won't see a utility truck for 5 days when our power goes out. That means people can keep their medicine and their food frozen, refrigerated. They can power their communication devices. That's very important. The cost of that inverter is actually a little bit less than its counterpart, and it's very easy for us to install. So there's definitely some capacity there, albeit on a small scale, but the cumulative effects could be quite significant for an entire community. The other area that we see opportunity...
And I apologize. If you can wrap up your comments, I just want to make sure we have time for the other two before the end of the committee in 9 minutes.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Energy Trust of Oregon fully funds solar-ready feasibility studies for any new construction. This enables us to give what we call space and chase for all of these installations, which makes it a lot more affordable for those down the road when it comes time to install. AC coupling technology is enabling us to design and install traditional solar systems that in the future, when the battery costs do go down, we will have space and chase and be in a position be poised to further increase the resiliency of our communities.
Thank you. And thank you for coming from Coos Bay.
You're welcome.
Great. Mr. Souza, or excuse me, Mr. Israel.
Hello, I'm Paul Israel, founder of Sunlight Solar, headquartered in Bend, Oregon, with offices in Oregon City, Massachusetts, and Connecticut. I'm also the interim president of the Oregon Solar Energy Industries Association. OSEA is a membership organization that represents solar installers, educational institutions, unions, and utilities, all having a vested interest in solar. Over a decade ago, our company helped install the solar panels on the roof of this building. This was the nation's first capital solar-powered. I could install that same system right now for half the cost. It would take us about a third of the space that the current panels take up right now because of increases in technology. I could drive up to Hillsboro actually to buy my panels now. We have a trained solar workforce that I could install the panels in less than half the time than we did. The underlying incentives on both residential and commercial systems have decreased more than 50%. Today, Oregon is one of the few states with a solar specialty code. We can actually walk in and get permits relatively fast on a fast-track issuance. It's not like that in most other states in the United States. Since we installed the Capitol system, Oregonians have collectively installed over 1 megawatt of solar. 100 megawatts of solar, excuse me. That's a enough solar to run a power plant. For example, Boardman operates at 550 megawatts. 100 megawatts means that over 10,000 families and businesses now generate a percentage of their power from solar. Overall, we estimate Oregonians have leveraged $200 million of federal taxes savings back into the Oregon economy. 100 megawatts equates to $400 million of work for solar electric companies and electrical contractors. During the recent recession, my company hired two journeyman electricians and a laid-off City of Bend inspector. At the Deschutes County permit desk, we were virtually the only folks in there pulling permits during a dismal economic time. I consistently receive resumes from graduates of Oregon schools such as OIT, COCC, and PSU, all interested in solar. Solar is really touching the lives of the young, and they are propelling our industry forward. Financing is more important than ever. 8 out of 10 installations in the future will be financed. OC is working to attract large capital investors to the state. We need a reliable and long-term program to finish that work. For the thousands of Oregonians that live in treed and shaded homes, we're working on virtual net metering and community solar, such as Brandon had showed today. That's fantastic. OC is working with a large inclusive tent to continue to bring down costs, and think through a cost-effective program for all of Oregonians in 2015. Thank you.
Thank you. We appreciate your time. Mr. Bissonnette.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Jeff Bissonnette with the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon. Just want to hit a couple of high points really quickly. First, you heard the term solar resource value. We had a lot of conversation about that topic in the last legislative session. That's essentially what the value of solar is to the system. I think as a ratepayer advocate, I can say that ratepayers can pay more for solar than we're paying today. There is additional value to the system that we're not capturing. The question is how much more. We don't know how much more, and we need kind of a rational way to figure that out, and we continue to wrestle with that. The important thing for you as policymakers is once we get a rational way to determine solar resource value, it actually, I think, creates a pathway to have a rational conversation around something like the Betsy, although we would never call it the Betsy again. Because once we determine the value to the system and figure out what the delta is between that number and the actual installation, we can actually then say, all right, this is how much we should be paying as taxpayers. This is the public policy question that we're doing for economic development. And then we can say, how many systems do we want to install and allocate that money accordingly? And so I think it brings some rationality to a policy discussion that, frankly, I don't think we had a lot of rationality about a few years ago. But one thing is true, and it's been said in this hearing and before, we do need a consistent state policy around solar and around all renewables, because otherwise industries don't know what to invest, customers don't know what to expect, and that's not a way to have a good ongoing policy programs or investments. I want to just quickly comment on a couple of other things. One is that the utilities often talk about cross-subsidization and sort of the impact if we start to see solar go wild. But at the same time, they point to, solar is really not a big part of the system. Right now, they can't have it both ways. They have, right now, we have a very small penetration of solar. It is growing. We do need to talk about some of the cross-subsidization issues. We do need to talk about how solar affects the overall system. But we have some time to talk about it. But we do need to be more engaged in more specific discussions around details, around numbers. I've offered myself up as a case study. I do have solar panels. I don't qualify for many of the demographics that PGE put up on as their discussion, as their average solar user, and so it does suggest that there's a better, broader market out there. But if we're going to talk about cross-subsidization, we really need to figure out who's subsidizing who at what level, and at what level we're we reach a danger point. And again, while those issues are could be real, are currently theoretical, and so we have time to sort of deal with them, but we do need to deal with them. And lastly, I just want to say that in response to a comment by Mr. Brown, who, you know, is frankly doing yeoman's work on this stuff, while the PUC may move slowly, it's the right place to have these very detailed and very weedy and very number-oriented discussion. And so I would encourage you as legislators to set clear policies, to set clear directions, and then turn over the details to the PUC and let them and stakeholders there work out those details with all due haste. But understanding that all due haste, you know, probably is in the several months rather than several weeks. That's all I had. Thank you very much. Happy to answer questions.
Thank you. And Mr. Bessonet, I am shocked to hear you imply that perhaps being a public ratepayer advocate does not file you into the wealthy category. So,
just wanted to be clear.
Yeah. Questions for this panel? Thank you so much. Thank you for traveling to be here, and thank you for your time. I want to thank everybody that came today for this informational hearing. I know I learned a lot. I think the committee did as well. I think you can tell the interest from the committee in this subject and in the continuing developments. It's a fast-changing industry and a fast-changing policy space, so we'll hope to continue the conversation on a frequent basis in order to make sure that we are continuing to be up to speed, and I'm sure we'll be hearing from you about ways that we can help support job creation in this area and continuing deployment of renewables and especially solar. So thank you very much, and with that, committee is adjourned.